From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
He's in charge of an oil company that's pretty much double the size of his next nearest competitor. It's been a company that's been unbelievably managed. And to me, a great advantage is he knows many of the players, and he knows them well. He does massive deals in Russia. He does massive deals for the company, not for himself, for the company.
President-elect Trump is expected to pick ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. Tillerson is already facing criticism for his close ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin and for Exxon's decades-long cover-up of the link between burning fossil fuels and global warming. We'll speak with a number of guests, including Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org.
Mr. Tillerson was boasting about how the company was going out and making new finds of oil in new places around the world. We have five times as much carbon in our reserves already as we can burn. The idea that we should celebrate the exploration for new hydrocarbons at this point goes past irony into some dark place that I don't really have a name for.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President-elect Donald Trump's expected to name ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. The selection prompted outrage and condemnation among environmental groups. Exposés by Inside Climate News and the Los Angeles Times have revealed Exxon knew that fossil fuels caused global warming as early as the 70s, but hid that information from the public and instead poured millions of dollars into PR efforts aimed at sowing doubt over the science of climate change. Responding to the possible nomination, 350.org Executive Director May Boovy said, quote, ExxonMobil is still a leading funder of climate denial and is pursuing a business plan that will destroy our future. Tillerson deserves a federal investigation, not federal office, she said. Tillerson has spent the past 41 years at Exxon, where he became chair and chief executive more than a decade ago. He has no experience in government service, nor in the diplomatic corps. Donald Trump praised Tillerson during an appearance on Fox News Sunday.
He's much more than a business executive. I mean, he's a world-class player. He's in charge of, I guess, the largest company in the world. He's in charge of an oil company that's pretty much double the size of his next nearest competitor. It's been a company that's been unbelievably managed. And to me, a great advantage is he knows many of the players, and he knows them well. He does massive deals in Russia. He does massive deals for the company, not for himself, for the company.
Tillerson is known to have close ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin, who awarded him the country's Order of Friendship decoration in 2013. Both Senate Democrats and Republicans have expressed concern over the potential nomination. This is Arizona Republican Senator John McCain speaking on CBS's Face the Nation.
It's a matter of concern to me that he has such a close personal relationship with Vladimir Putin, and obviously they've done enormous deals together, that would color his approach to Vladimir Putin and the Russian threat.
News of Tillerson's potential selection came one day after President Obama ordered a review of Russia's role in influencing the presidential election. The CIA has reportedly concluded Russia intervened in the election to help Trump win. This is incoming Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York.
For years, foreign adversaries have directed cyber attacks at America's physical, economic, and military infrastructure while stealing our intellectual property. Now, our democratic institutions have been targeted. Recent reports of Russian interference in our election should alarm every American.
Donald Trump rejected allegations that Russia aided his Electoral College victory as ridiculous. In a statement, the Trump transition team said, quote, these are the same people that said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Meanwhile, Donald Trump was questioned by Chris Wallace of Fox News Sunday over his plans to skip daily presidential intelligence briefings.
I just want to ask you about your skepticism about the intelligence community. You are getting the presidential daily brief only once a week.
Well, I get it when I need it.
But is there some skepticism?
First of all, these are very good people that are giving me the briefings. And I say, if something should change from this point, immediately call me. I'm available on 1 minute's notice. I don't have to be told, you know, I'm like a smart person. I don't have to be told the same thing and the same words every single day for the next 8 years.
During his interview on Fox News Sunday, Trump also promised he would quickly decide the fate of the Dakota Access and Keystone XL pipelines once taking office. He said he's studying the Paris Climate Agreement to see if it would give China or other countries an advantage over the U.S. Trump's comments came just days after the Trump transition team sent a memo to employees of the Department of Energy questioning their work on climate change. The 74-page questionnaire requests, among other things, information on which employees attended UN climate talks and demands justification for a program tracking the nation's carbon dioxide pollution. One Energy Department employee, speaking anonymously, told Reuters, quote, "This feels like the first draft of an eventual political enemies list." In international news, Syrian government forces backed by intense Russian airstrikes have captured most of eastern Aleppo, pinning down remaining anti-government fighters in a tiny part of the city. The offensive is now poised to give President Bashar al-Assad of Syria one of his biggest victories in the nearly six-year-old civil war. Reuters is reporting rebels in Aleppo have been offered a U.S.-backed proposal that would see them put down their weapons in exchange for safe passage to a place of their choice. Russia is denying any such deal has been reached. Elsewhere in Syria, fighters with the self-proclaimed Islamic State have recaptured the ancient city of Palmyra, along with surrounding oil and gas fields. ISIS previously held Palmyra from May of 2015 till last March, when its fighters were driven out by fighters from Syria, Russia, and Lebanon's Hezbollah militia. Palmyra is home to about 50,000 people, and its ancient ruins are a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Many of the ruins, which date back to the Roman Empire, were destroyed by ISIS the last time the group held the city. In Turkey, a pair of bombs ripped through crowds outside in Istanbul's soccer stadium Saturday night, killing 38 people and wounding 166 others. A splinter group of the banned Kurdish Workers' Party, or PKK, claimed responsibility for the bombings. In response, the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, convened an emergency security meeting and vowed to crush Kurdish militants.
What we must focus on is this terror burden. Our people should have no doubt we will continue our battle against terror until the end. If they plan to intimidate us with these attacks, we have not degraded ourselves to leave the arena to these cowards.
A report by Amnesty International last week estimated a 500,000 people have been forced from their homes in southeastern Turkey amidst a brutal government crackdown in majority Kurdish regions. In Egypt, a bomb exploded during Sunday Mass in Cairo's main Coptic Christian cathedral, killing 25 people and wounding nearly 50 others. The blast tore apart pews and seared pillars, leaving at least six children among the dead. There's been no claim of responsibility. It was the worst violence against Egypt's minority Christian population since a series of attacks in 2011. Meanwhile, in Somalia, a suicide truck bomb exploded at Somalia's biggest port Sunday, killing at least 29 people. Militants from the group Al-Shabaab have claimed responsibility. France's socialist government will ask Parliament to extend a state of emergency, granting officials sweeping powers of search, seizure and detention. If approved, it would be the fifth such renewal of emergency rules since terrorist attacks in November of 2015 that killed 130 people. The French prime minister said the extension was needed at least through presidential and general elections next spring.
Each of us should bear in mind the reality of the context that we're living in, a particularly high level of terrorist threat.
France's emergency rule curtails freedom of assembly and includes measures that permit police raids without a warrant. Human Rights Watch has said the emergency powers undermine human rights and the rule of law. In Alabama Thursday night, a condemned prisoner heaved and coughed for nearly 15 minutes after prison officials injected him with the first of three drugs meant to stop his heart. Witnesses to the execution said Ronald Burt Smith moved his lips, clenched a fist, opened one eye after prison officials administered him the sedative midazolam, a drug that has been linked to other botched executions. The execution came after the U.S. Supreme Court declined to intervene in Smith's death penalty case. twice in a 4-4 tie vote. Smith was placed on death row in 1994 after a judge overruled a jury's decision to sentence him to life in prison. Alabama's the only U.S. state to allow that practice. In Denver, Colorado, Mayor Michael Hancock says he will no longer order police to seize winter survival gear, including tents and sleeping bags, from the city's homeless residents. The move came after videos of officers snatching blankets from homeless men and women went viral. Advocates for the homeless say the practice threatened the lives of people at risk of freezing to death. The U.S. Senate has approved a bill granting $170 million to Flint, Michigan, to help replace pipes that are leaching toxic lead into Flint's drinking water. Flint's lead poisoning crisis began last year when an unelected emergency manager appointed by Michigan Governor Rick Snyder switched the source of the city's drinking water to the corrosive Flint River. Today, the water in Flint is still poisoned and unsafe to drink. Meanwhile, environmentalists are warning of a provision of the bill which rolls back protections to California's Bay Delta estuary. Environmentalists say the changes threaten delicate ecosystems and undermine the Endangered Species Act. In Philadelphia, hundreds of people gathered Friday for a march in protest to demand life-saving medication for imprisoned journalist and former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal and for all Pennsylvania prisoners suffering from the unconstitutional denial of treatment for their hepatitis C. The protests marked 35 years since December 9, 1981, when Mumia Abu-Jamal was shot by Philadelphia police, arrested and then charged with the murder of white police officer Daniel Faulkner. Abu-Jamal has always maintained his innocence. Amnesty International has found he was deprived a fair trial. Mumia Abu-Jamal has spent the majority of his time in prison on death row. This is Baltimore Reverend C.D. Witherspoon.
We understand that when they took him off of death row, what the strategy was for him to die sick behind bars. But we're not going to allow for our brother to die behind bars, because we were in captivation. He fought for our liberation. Yes. And so, brothers and sisters, we got to fight for him to be liberated. We got to fight for him to receive dignity and respect. What kind of nation would half our brother be in prison and not to receive the type of medication that he deserves? I call that barbaric.
That's Baltimore Reverend C.D. Witherspoon. Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos Saturday accepted the Nobel Peace Prize for his role in crafting a peace deal with FARC rebels, ending a half-century of civil war that left a 250,000 people dead. At a ceremony in Oslo, Norway, President Santos hailed the Nobel Prize as a gift from heaven and dedicated it to all Colombians affected by the fighting. In his wide-ranging acceptance speech, Santos also said nations, including the U.S. and Colombia, need to rethink the war on drugs.
It makes no sense to imprison a peasant who grows marijuana, when nowadays, for example, its cultivation and use are legal in 8 states of the United States. The manner in which this war against drugs is being waged is equally or perhaps even more harmful than all the wars the world is fighting today combined. It's time to change our strategy.
And the Nobel Committee presented prizes for medicine, economics, physics, chemistry and literature in a gala ceremony in Stockholm, Sweden. Notably absent was Bob Dylan, winner of this year's Nobel Prize for Literature. Accepting the award on Dylan's behalf was legendary singer, poet and author Patti Smith, who performed "A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall."
It's a hard rain's gonna fall.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President-elect Donald Trump is expected to nominate ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. Tillerson has served as CEO and chair of Exxon since 2006. Environmental groups have widely condemned the potential nomination. Exxon's facing multiple lawsuits over its role in covering up the science behind climate change. In 2015, Inside Climate News and the Los Angeles Times revealed ExxonMobil's own research had confirmed the role of fossil fuels in global warming decades ago. By 1977, Exxon's senior experts had begun to warn the burning of fossil fuels could pose a threat to humanity. Exxon initially launched an ambitious research program to study carbon dioxide in the air and ocean. But toward the end of the 1980s, Exxon changed course and shifted to the forefront of climate change denial. Since the 1990s, it's spent millions of dollars funding efforts to reject the science its own experts knew of decades ago. Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson is also known to have close ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin. The Wall Street Journal reports Tillerson has known Putin since he represented Exxon's interests in Russia during the regime of Boris Yeltsin. In 2013, Putin awarded Tillerson the country's Order of Friendship decoration. To talk more about Rex Tillerson, we're joined by three guests. In Washington, D.C., Eric Pica is with us. He's president of Friends of the Earth USA. Here in New York, Carol Moffat is with us, president and CEO of the Center for International Environmental Law, personally subpoenaed by Exxon in a case in Texas seeking to stop an investigation into Exxon's activities led by the Massachusetts Attorney General. 10 other individuals and organizations have also been subpoenaed. And we're joined via Democracy Now! Video stream by Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org. In 2014, Bill McKibben was awarded the Right Livelihood Prize, sometimes called the Alternative Nobel, for his work in environmental activism, author of a number of books, including Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! We're going to begin today with Carol. Talk about your response to hearing that Rex Tillerson, the current CEO of ExxonMobil, might be the Secretary of State.
I'll say that when the news first came out, I assumed it was a grim, practical joke. As it became more real, our response is that it is irresponsible and it's unconscionable. It poses a threat not only to the planet, but to human rights. To put the CEO of Exxon in charge of our negotiations on climate change, our negotiations on oil, on energy, on human rights with countries around the world where this company has interests, where it has a track record of abuses, is patently irresponsible.
Now, what is your personal involvement here? Why were you subpoenaed?
You would have to ask Exxon that. Our best guess is that Exxon subpoenaed me because of the work that my organization, the Center for International Environmental Law, has done to expose Exxon's history of climate research and its history of climate denial. Our research, published last summer, demonstrated that Exxon and its oil industry allies were actually doing climate research as early as 1957, and that they had been warned by no later than 1968 that fossil fuels were directly linked to climate change.
And so what do you have to do?
We have filed objections to the subpoena, noting that the subpoena is nothing more than a fishing expedition, that I'm not a party to the case, and that if you look at the subpoena that Exxon has filed, it's clear that it goes far beyond any issues in the case and is a clear effort to intimidate and suppress those who have criticized the company.
That's interesting, because at the same time—and I want to ask Eric Pica this question of Friends of the Earth—you have this questionnaire, Donald Trump's transition team circulating a 74-part questionnaire at the Department of Energy that requests the names of employees who have attended climate talks over the last 5 years. From these subpoenas to a kind of—well, would you call it an enemies list?
Absolutely. I mean, this dates back to the red baiting and McCarthyism. This is like, you know, the head of the transition team, Myron Abel, who is head of the energy and climate transition team. He's with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's been a funded ExxonMobil climate denier, and now he's using that position to go out and find the climate change enemies list in the Department of Energy, and who knows how far it's going to go into the Environmental Protection Agency, NASA, all these agencies that have something to do with climate change, you see both the appointees, the proposed appointees, as well as the transition team, trying to undermine the trust, undermine the capacity of these civil servants who are doing really good work on behalf of the American people, undermining their capacity to address what is scientifically proven and what they were doing on behalf of the Obama administration.
Well, let's back up and let me get your reaction, Eric Pica, to the possible nomination. Donald Trump is not denying that he's his first pick, but hasn't actually made that choice yet, maybe kind of floating this to see how people respond, to Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson being nominated as Secretary of State.
Say, I agree with Carol. At first, I thought it was a joke. And then, you know, in thinking about it, you know, Rex Tillerson should be indicted for corporate fraud and for lying to the American public, lying to the world, lying to their shareholders. And so he should be strung up and the company should be strung up in the court of law for fraud. And instead, he's being rewarded by President-elect Trump with perhaps one of the most important cabinet picks in the U.S. government, the State Department, the head of the State Department. So it is kind of this interesting and weird, bizarro world that we're now living in underneath Trump.
Bill McKibben, we're reaching you at your home in Vermont. Has the snowstorm hit yet?
No, just a little snowstorm this morning.
Uh-huh.
It is beautiful, I must say.
So can you talk about your thoughts when you heard that the Exxon CEO might be named Secretary of State or nominated? It will have to go to Congress.
Yes, it will. And I think that there'll be some opposition, actually, in Congress and across the aisle, perhaps, because not only is Mr. Tillerson been actively engaged in trying to slow progress on climate change. He also, and the reporting on this is emerging kind of even as we speak, he and his company are deeply embedded in the Russian oil business. And it is going to, I mean, conflict of interest doesn't begin to cover the questions that are being raised by good reporters this morning. I will say, I was perhaps a little less surprised than Eric and Carol by all of this. I think that what's going on is that the Trump administration has decided to drop all pretense. They are fully engaged in full-on climate denial, and they are fully clients of the fossil fuel industry. You know, for a very long time, the fossil fuel industry has wielded undue power in our political affairs under both Democratic and Republican administrations. You'll recall that it was Dick Cheney, who had been helping run Halliburton, the oil service company, that dominated the George W. Bush administration. But in this case, they've literally decided to cut out the middleman, and now the world's biggest fossil fuel company, and in many of the most recent years, the most profitable company on Earth, the biggest company the world has ever seen, is just basically going to be in charge of things.
You know, it reminded me back in 1953 and 1954 what happened when Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, who was a white-collar lawyer representing United Fruit, first in 1953, the U.S., and this is all documented now, overthrew the democratically elected leader of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, on behalf of Anglo-Iranian Oil, the precursor to BP. And the next year moved in on Guatemala. Secretary of State John Foster Dulles had represented United Fruit at his corporate law firm. And on behalf of United Fruit, overthrew the democratically elected government of Guatemala. Your thoughts, Bill McKibben?
I think that it's a perfectly good analogy. The only difference and the only thing that makes it grimmer here is that the damage that we're talking about is going to be permanent. We're at an absolute critical moment in dealing with climate change. The world had begun to get a tiny, not enormous, but a tiny bit of momentum going in the right direction. And clearly, the goal of the Trump administration is to stomp on that momentum. The president said, president-elect said yesterday that no one can really know whether climate change is real or not. That, of course, is absurd. Every climatologist knows that it's real, and increasingly, billions of people around the Earth know that it's real because they're feeling its effects. But the most important player in the international scene on this question is now going to, at the very least, take itself out of the game and more likely try hard to obstruct real progress. This damage won't last for decades. This damage will last for geologic time.
I'd like to turn to a clip of Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson. During an address to the Council on Foreign Relations in 2012, he said fears about climate change are overblown.
And clearly there's going to be an impact. So I'm not disputing that increasing CO2 emissions in the atmosphere is going to have an impact. It'll have a warming impact. We believe those consequences are manageable. They do require us to begin to exert or spend more policy effort on adaptation. What do you want to do if we think the future has sea level rising 4 inches, 6 inches? Where are the impacted areas, and what do you want to do to adapt to that? And as human beings, as a species, that's why we're all still here. We have spent our entire existence adapting. Okay, so we will adapt to this. Changes to weather patterns that move crop production areas around, we'll adapt to that. It's an engineering problem, and it has engineering solutions.
Carol Moffett, your response.
It's emblematic of the industry's response for decades. Delay, deny, deny, delay, and ultimately, when the problem becomes intractable, say that we can adapt and it will be someone else's responsibility. I think the challenge is when you look at what adaptation means for millions of people living in coastal regions, living in river deltas that face unpredictable flooding, that face drought, that face starvation. I think that it is, I think it's emblematic of a company and an individual who sees every problem as an engineering problem rather than as a social problem, an economic problem, and a problem of human rights.
Hmm. Eric Pica, let's look at the appointments so far. You have Scott Pruitt to head the EPA, one of the major foes of the Environmental Protection Agency. Jeff Sessions, Attorney General. We haven't talked as much about President-elect Trump's choice to head the Department of Interior, Kathy McMorris Rodgers. Can you talk about her and then this overall picture of his planned cabinet that we know so far?
Yeah, I mean, his cabinet's appoint nominees are the worst when it comes to understanding climate change and perpetuating climate denialism. Here we have Kathy McMorris Rodgers, who has a lifetime record with the League of Conservation Voters of 4%. She has voted or led to fight President Obama's Clean Power Plan. She's wanted to auction off public lands to the highest bidder for the extraction of oil and gas and timber. She has supported Clive Bundy, you know, in his group that took over Oregon in an armed revolt. She was one of 15 members of Congress that actually supported the takeover of the Oregon park. And so McMorris Rodgers, she is aligned with some of the most radical anti-environmental, anti-climate movements here in the United States. And she's now going to, she's been nominated to now run the Department of the Interior, which is responsible for managing 500 million acres of U.S. public lands. And so Friends of the Earth and 350, many of us have said, you know, we have to keep fossil fuels in the ground, which means that the federal government cannot lease any more oil, coal, and natural gas. And now we have an Interior Department official who not only doesn't believe in climate change, but wants to sell off those public lands to the highest bidder or the lowest bidder. I think she doesn't really care. She just wants to sell them off for the express purpose of extracting as fast as possible. And this is a trend that we've seen with Scott Pruitt at the Environmental Protection Agency, the former attorney general, the current attorney general of Oklahoma, who has opposed each of the major rules that President Obama has tried to put in place to regulate climate change, provide for safer water, and for public health. And now he's going to be the head of the Environmental Protection Agency if he's not opposed. You look at Sessions for the U.S. Attorney General, and he has actually tried to squash the investigation that's been spurred on into ExxonMobil's, how they've treated corporate shareholders and whether or not they lied to them. And so we can see Sessions gutting not only the Environmental Crimes Division at the Department of Justice, but also the Civil Rights Division. And what he has put in place is a series of appointees that will do the bidding of the fossil fuel industry to suppress the right to vote, to suppress people's speech, and to then give these fossil fuel polluters a free ride when it comes to their responsibility to both pay for climate damages as well as to cut their own production of fossil fuels.
The League of Conservation Voters, as you said, gave Kathy McMorris Rodgers a zero in its most recent ratings. Here she is speaking out in 2015 in favor of the Keystone XL pipeline.
We stand here very proud to have just voted for the 11th time in the House of Representatives to approve the Keystone Pipeline project. We voted to approve more than 40,000 American jobs. We voted for energy innovation, energy independence. We voted to say yes to American energy.
That's Republican Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rodgers of Washington State. Bill McKibben, your response.
Well, look, Eric's right. This is all of a piece, and the piece is that the fossil fuel industry is now going to be dominant in Washington unless we can stop these people from being confirmed. And even if we can, they will find some others, the Trump administration of the same vein. What I think we need to say over and over and over again is the era of any pretense is over. These guys now own lock, stock, and barrel the policy that they're putting forward. As the planet goes south, everyone will start to realize exactly who and why it's happening. And in that sense, and in that sense only, there's something useful about all of this. The era of any pretense that we're working hard to both deal with climate change and help the oil industry and whatever, that's over. Now we're doing one thing. Federal policy is going to be all about helping the fossil fuel industry, and the results of that will be squarely on the people who are doing this. We will do everything that we can to slow them down in that process, but we will also continue day after day to point out what it is precisely that's going on, because they're breaking the planet, and as it breaks, we're going to have to react in a truly powerful way going forward.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion. Bill McKibben is speaking to us from his home in Vermont. Carol Muffett is president and CEO of the Center for International Environmental Law, personally subpoenaed by Exxon in a case in Texas seeking to stop an investigation into Exxon's activities led by the Massachusetts Attorney General. And Eric Pica will be leaving us, president of Friends of the Earth USA, and will be joined by Joe Rahm. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you.
Future markets. Music from the motion picture There Will Be Blood. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation about ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson, who Donald Trump is expected to nominate for Secretary of State. Speaking on Face the Nation Sunday, Senator John McCain said Tillerson should be given a fair hearing, but reiterated his concerns about Tillerson's ties to Vladimir Putin.
Ties are strictly commercial and got to do with his business in the oil business, fine. But we'll give him a fair hearing. But is it a matter of concern? Certainly it should be a matter of concern. But I'm sure that in a bipartisan way, he'll get a fair hearing. But it's a matter of concern to me that he has such a close personal relationship with Vladimir Putin. And obviously they've done enormous deals together, that would color his approach to Vladimir Putin and the Russian threat.
One of the enormous deals that Vladimir Putin and Rex Tillerson worked on was a $500 billion oil exploration partnership between Exxon and the Russian government's oil company, Rosneft. The Obama administration blocked the deal when it imposed sanctions against Russia for its intervention in Ukraine. In a recent column for Think Progress, headlined Trump, Putin, and ExxonMobil Team Up to Destroy the Planet, Joe Rahm, founding editor of Climate Progress, writes, this deal could explain why Putin appears to have interfered in U.S. elections in favor of a Trump victory. Rahm goes on to say, if the sanctions are lifted, something a new Secretary of State could help make happen, it would pay off big time for Exxon. Imagine if the oil giant is free to produce and sell oil on the staggering 63.7 million acres of Russian land it leases, which is over five times the amount of land it leases in this country. Happy days are here again for Exxon, Joe Rahm writes. Well, for more, we are joined by Joe Rahm in Washington, D.C., who also was chief science advisor for years of Living Dangerously. So, Joe Rahm, for people who have no idea what this is about, this Rosneft deal and the sanctions and what it would mean if they're lifted, please lay it out for us.
Sure. Well, Rosneft is the state oil company for Russia. And under Putin, it has been acquiring more and more power and control over the oil industry. And it is now, I believe, the world's largest oil entity in the world. ExxonMobil is the world's largest, privately held oil company in the world. And, we're entering a period where it's harder and harder to find oil. And as I write in Climate Progress, ExxonMobil's prospects for finding, easy to find oil in this market is, were pretty dim until this deal was struck between Tillerson and Putin, basically. And this deal would have created a $500 billion a joint effort, the biggest oil deal ever. It's $500 billion. We're talking half $1 trillion. This is a staggering amount of money. It was a deal that was perhaps going to ensure the future of a stream of oil for Exxon for decades to come, even, of course, as the world needs to get off of oil. For Putin, this is critical revenue and critical outside investment, because particularly now in this era of low oil prices, that seriously hurts Putin. So this was considered to be a game changer. Rachel Maddow said, this was a deal that was considered it might change the historical trajectory of Russia. Now, Putin then invaded Crimea and interfered with Ukraine. As a result, the United States and most other civilized countries put in place sanctions. Those sanctions in 2014 killed this deal. And, as I write in the piece, the question of the intelligence community now says that Russia interfered in the election on behalf of Putin. That through leaks, through hacking private email accounts and releasing them, drip, drip, drip. And also, we have reason to believe they're one of the major promoters, disseminators of fake news. So, one can understand the motivation You know, some people said, hey, Putin has enough motivation just to, you know, cast doubt on the U.S. election. But $500 billion, that is a very big motivation to mess up the U.S. election.
Explain what could happen if Tillerson did become Secretary of State.
Well, if Tillerson becomes Secretary of State, and I also want to say the man has no qualifications to be Secretary of State. It just deserves to be said. He's worked for ExxonMobil his entire life. And I know we've entered this realm where we just elected, Donald Trump president, who is unqualified, and he's been naming a series of people who are unqualified for their job. But it just needs to be said. So Tillerson has no qualifications for his job, and the deal that he was negotiating with Putin 2 years ago won him the highest order that Russia gives to a foreign citizen. So he and Putin are very, very close. And as Secretary of State, of course, he is our lead negotiator. He's the president's top representative to every foreign government in the world. So here's the signal it sends to the rest of the world. All that matters to the United States is oil and a friendly relationship with Putin. Now, you know, this is a totally, totally compromised Secretary of State. It is absurd. In any sane, rational world, this would just be round-the-clock pillory.
How could Tillerson decide about, for example, lifting the sanctions? What role would the Secretary of State play if he gets that job?
Let's look at the sanctions from two different. There's the U.S. sanctions, which the Obama can pretty much, I mean, which President Trump can pretty much lift most of himself. But then there's all the other countries who have sanctions. And in order to make a economic deal between Exxon and Rosneft, Russia, work, you're going to need not just allowing U.S. investment in the country. You're going to have to allow Russia, you know, to make deals and sell oil with every other country. So as Secretary of State, he can simply make it his top priority to use the full leverage of the United States in every deal to benefit the oil industry, to benefit the U.S. oil industry, to benefit Rosneft, to benefit Putin. It's basically would be turning the U.S. State Department and the U.S. executive branch into what Russia is, a kleptocracy run by Putin and his gang to extract money and enrich themselves.
And, Joe Rahm, what about his own wealth? What about Rex Tillerson's own wealth? He is the current CEO of Exxon. If he retires and becomes president and becomes Secretary of State, still his money is tied up in Exxon, in what happens to Exxon, what the Secretary, what the State Department and other government agencies, how they relate to Exxon.
Yes, and he would presumably divest. He would presumably have to sell off his $100+ million worth of shares of ExxonMobil, and because of the way the law is written, he can do that tax-free. But I think it's important to say that, you know, someone who has worked his life, all his life at ExxonMobil, all the way up to the top of the company, is hardly going to be able to separate his interests and the interests of all of his close personal friends and family simply by divesting himself of the stock. He is ExxonMobil, and you should just see that on his forehead whenever you look at it.
Carol Moffat, we just have a minute, but you're seeing one agency head after another, one cabinet member named after another, related to Exxon, in fact.
Yes. If you look at Jeff Sessions, he intervened in the investigations of Exxon. If you look at Scott Pruitt, the nominee for EPA, he intervened in the investigation of Exxon by other state attorneys general. Then you add Rex Tillerson, and on climate change, what we're looking at is government of Exxon, by Exxon, and for Exxon. But it's really important to recognize that this is emblematic of a broader trend that we're seeing in Trump's nominations, where in one agency after another, he has put people in charge of agencies that are patently hostile to both the agency itself and to the people and places those agencies are designed to protect. It's looking to move us 100 years backward in time and undo 100 years of environmental and social progress.
And finally, Bill McKibben, one of his transition team representatives, said today on one of the talk shows that this is a man who is very accomplished in business, so he'll be reviewing the budget of the State Department and, you know, who should be there and who shouldn't. We hear about the Department of Energy. Donald Trump just said he'll be deciding very soon after becoming president what to do about the Dakota Access Pipeline, which the Obama administration has said no to granting the final permit to, and the Keystone XL, which your group 350.org and so many others fought so hard until Obama, President Obama, said no to the Keystone XL. Finally, what does this mean, and how is 350.org organizing?
2016 is the hottest year in human history, and we're going to have to make 2017 as politically hot as it is humanly possible to do. If people have been keeping their powder dry, waiting to come out and engage in peaceful protest, well, this is the moment. Everything is at risk, both in terms of our democracy and our planet. And so we will organize at 350, just as people will organize all over the country, and we'll do it not with complete confidence that we're going to win. We'll do it because we have to do it, and we will see what happens. This is one of those hinge moments in human history and actually in planetary history, too. I'm not sure there's ever been one quite like it, Amy.
Well, I want to go end with a clip from Fox News this Sunday. Donald Trump interviewed by Chris Wallace on the pipeline.
Let me ask you a couple of specific questions. Will you still pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement, which has been signed by more than 100 countries to reduce carbon emissions? Will you restart the Dakota Access Pipeline, which the Army just stopped?
Okay. Let me not answer the Dakota, because perhaps that'll be solved by the time I get there, so I don't have to create enemies on one side or the other. But I will tell you, when I get to office, if it's not solved, I'll have it solved very quickly.
Meaning you're going to start it?
I'm not saying anything. I just say something will happen, and it'll be quick. I think it's very unfair. So it'll start one way or the other. You'll
Paris?
Have a decision pretty quickly. And also the Keystone Pipeline, you're going to have a decision fairly quickly. And you'll see that. Now, Paris, I'm studying. I do say this. I don't want that agreement to put us at a competitive disadvantage with other countries. And as you know, there are different times and different time limits on that agreement. I don't want that to give China or other countries signing agreements an advantage over us.
That's Donald Trump yesterday on Fox News. We will wrap up there. And in our next segment, we'll look back at the investigation by the Los Angeles Times and Inside Climate News into how ExxonMobil covered up its own knowledge of human-induced climate change. I want to thank Joe Romg of Climate Progress, Carol Moffat of the Center for International Environmental Law, and Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org. Stay with us.
You get the car, I'll get the night off. You'll get the chance to take the world apart and figure out how it works. Don't let me know what you find out. I need a car, you need a guide, you need a map. If I don't die, I want to see it when you find out what comets, stars, and moons are all about. Want to see that.
Car by Built to Spill here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report, with President-elect Donald Trump expected to nominate ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. We want to turn to an investigative series by the Pulitzer Prize-winning news organization Inside Climate News, which revealed Exxon knew that fossil fuels caused global warming as early as the 70s, but hid that information from the public. This is a clip from 2015 from the PBS series Frontline, which partnered with Inside Climate News on the project.
We found a trail of documents that go back to 1977. Exxon knew carbon dioxide was increasing in the atmosphere, that combustion of fossil fuels is driving it, and that this posed a threat to Exxon. At that time, Exxon understood very quickly that governments would probably take action to reduce fossil fuel consumption. They're smart people, great scientists, and they saw the writing on the wall.
One Exxon research project outfitted an oil tanker with equipment to measure CO2 levels in the atmosphere and the ocean.
We were collecting data of the southern Atlantic, the Gulf of Mexico, and the western Indian Ocean. Basically, every hour we would get several measurements, so we had, I called it a data monster.
Today, Exxon says the study had nothing to do with CO2 emissions, but scientists involved remembered it differently.
We were committed. We were doing some serious science. It was a significant budget, I would say on the scale of $1 million a year. And that was a lot of money in 1979.
That was Ed Garvey. From 1978 to 83, he was a researcher at Exxon, where he helped start the company's greenhouse gas research program. Well, last year, Nermeen Sheikh and I interviewed him, as well as Neela Banerjee of Inside Climate News. I began by asking Neela about the investigation by her news organization.
We started looking into early climate change research and became aware that oil companies, at least initially it was BP, but that was, you know, later in the 90s, had their own scientists who were looking into this. We then found out from American scientists, government scientists who'd been involved in climate research in the 80s, that Exxon was involved. And what ended up happening was that I got a transcript of a 1979 congressional hearing on climate change, and tried to see if somebody from Exxon was there, and I found a gentleman named Henry Shaw. Henry was Ed's boss and was the primary researcher with that tanker project. And through him and you know, papers that he worked on, we found other names, we found documents and archives, and slowly we amassed this picture of a company that was clearly aware of the science, of the emerging science of carbon dioxide research, and what the scientists were saying, that it was largely driven by fossil fuel emissions. And they were smart enough to know that this could mean some kind of policy response farther down the road. And so to deal with that, they decided to take a constructive role, and that is to do really good science so that they would be taken seriously in any future policy discussion.
And Ed Garvey, can you talk about when you first arrived at Exxon and the research that you did there? It's an extraordinary finding. 1977, that's almost 40 years ago that Exxon itself was aware of the climate impacts of fossil fuel.
I was hired in 1978 by Henry Shaw specifically to begin the tanker study. He hired me explicitly directly out of school. I was almost 22-year-old chemical engineer. But he hired me directly out of school to begin to engineer, if you would, and design a system that could work on an oil tanker to study oceanic levels of CO2. The idea was to study what the ocean was doing in response to the atmosphere so we could figure out where CO2 from fossil fuels was ending up.
And what'd you find?
Well, we didn't get that far along in terms of the data analysis. I mean, ultimately, we found we estimated the amount of CO2 that was coming out of the oceans and the equator. My thesis advisor at the time, Taro Takahashi, used that data along with other data, to estimate the amount of absorption by the ocean in the poles, amount of degassing in the equatorial area, and together he was able to estimate the carbon balance, if you would, around the ocean, the atmosphere, and the biosphere.
But why was Exxon, from what you understand, why was Exxon interested in doing this research then?
It was very much a—they sort of as a leadership role in many respects. The goal was that if Exxon—given the importance of the problem, Exxon wanted to be at the table in terms of the discussion. The best way to be considered viable in terms of your opinion at the table was to be doing real research. And in fact, we linked up with some of the best researchers in the world at the time regarding CO2 and the global carbon cycle.
You were working with Columbia University?
That's right.
Yes, go ahead.
As well as the Scripps Institute of Oceanography.
When did you start to feel a change in attitude at Exxon about the work you were doing?
For me, it came very suddenly toward the end of my career there. It was gung-ho for 3.5 years, and then the bottom fell out of the oil market, and it really changed. They just basically dropped the project. We had collected a lot of data, but hadn't processed it to the point of understanding the information. We just had a lot of information. Columbia went on to process the data after my work there.
Neela Banerjee, can you talk about this turnaround, when Exxon stopped the study, what they started to understand, and how they tried to cover it up?
Well, when Ed's project was dropped, from the documents we have and you know, talking to Ed, too, it was mainly because of financial reasons. Exxon did not stop its climate research. After it started the tanker project in 78-79. In 1980, it hired a lot of mathematicians to do climate modeling, because models were primitive and they were relying on other people's models, and they wanted to do that in-house. So even though the tanker project, which was relatively expensive, had ended, Exxon continued very good, rigorous, peer-reviewed climate research, mainly through climate modeling, from 1980 onward. And our documents go through 1986. And one does not notice the kind of attitude shift that appeared in the 1990s of stalling action on climate change and so on in that period. Exxon was still committed to doing really good science. It was just different from the tanker project. If that was empirical, this was modeling. And then, you know, the first indication that I think all of us, not just Inside Climate News, but the world have of Exxon's attitude on climate change shifting was in 1989, when a group called the Global Climate Coalition was formed. And that was a group of fossil fuel companies, major manufacturers, Americans largely, that wanted to stall action on climate change. They saw that the UN was meeting and thinking about a policy response a country should adopt to cut emissions of carbon dioxide. So what happened in that 86 to 89 period? We don't know. We can't document a shift in thinking. There's some speculation about the attitudes of the people who were in leadership then. They were different than the people who were in leadership in the 70s. But what we have is not an example of a cover-up. It's quite the opposite. What we have is an example of a company that used its resources as one of the biggest energy companies in the world to do really good research.
Neela Banerjee, could you say a little more about this Global Climate Coalition and what Exxon's role within it came to be, and how it's impacted the kind of research that's done on climate change?
Well, the Global Climate Coalition, I mean, it sounds very green. I remember thinking, oh, this must be a group of companies that actually support action on climate change. But it was led mainly by the auto industry. I'm sorry, by the oil and gas industry, but some of the other members were coal companies, auto companies, and so on. And Exxon was probably the leader in the oil industry, working with the American Petroleum Institute, which is the main oil industry lobby. And they didn't take the approach that a lot of people who denied climate change did. And in fact, there's in public circulation, long before we did this project, a primer that a scientist had written for members about how to talk about climate change. What he recommended was not to use the arguments that other climate deniers use, such as, you know, that it's sunspots or natural cycles, but instead to focus on the uncertainty of the science and the models, just to hammer away at that. And indeed,
Neela Banerjee of Inside Climate News and former Exxon scientist Ed Garvey speaking on Democracy Now! Last year. You can go to Democracy Now! For the full interview, democracynow.org. That investigation by Inside Climate News and the Los Angeles Times led to a number of attorneys general announcing a historic effort to investigate Exxon and other oil companies for misleading the public about climate change. And that does it for our broadcast. A very happy birthday to Igor Moreno. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Malkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, and Andre Lewis. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, and Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.